From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as firearm deer season opens up, we look at why there are fewer hunters going after those deer.
When we look into the future, all of the data suggests that the number of hunters is going to continue to decline.
Saving college kids from suicide.
It's scary. It is a silent epidemic, and I don't know what will it take for us to wake up to it.
You need to have the discussion with your child that, you know, mental health is as important as your physical health. And, you know, it's okay to ask for help.
What Michigan can take away from losing the race for Amazon's second headquarters?
It might be just a kick in the pants that we needed.
And does Dan Gilbert want to buy the Detroit Tigers? Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hunters are taking to the woods in Michigan, guns in hand, for this opening day of the firearm deer hunting season. It's estimated hunting pumps some $2.3 billion into Michigan's economy every year. But hunting is on the decline, and it turns out that's going to matter to more than just the hunters. Rochelle Winkler is an associate professor of sociology and demography at Michigan Tech in Houghton, and she's been studying the demographics of hunting. We want to start by giving a hat tip to Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny. He took a very deep dive into this subject, which is how we learned, Rochelle, about you and your research. So you found Michigan's hunting population has fallen more than 20% since its peak in 1998. What's going on?
Well, you know, the peak population of hunters in about 1998 was really driven by the baby boom generation. There are a lot of people in that generation, and we found that they have participated in hunting at high rates across their life course. So that combination of those two things really drove the number of hunters in Michigan and across the Midwest to very high numbers through the 1980s and 1990s. But since that time, as we start to see the baby boomers age and eventually phase out of the hunting population, the younger generations of people that have followed them have not participated at the same kind of rates.
When you think of this younger generation, you've pointed to some cultural shifts that make hunting very attractive to baby boomers and maybe not so much to the younger generation. What factors stick out most to you on this front?
You know, I think a lot of it is related to urbanization, but that urbanization takes a long time period to manifest, really generations, because people who grow up in more urban areas, like many of the baby boomers did, were still, for the most part, less than one generation removed from the farm. Their parents may have grown up on the farm. Their grandparents still had there are more rural properties. And so they had those ties and places that they could go back to. I think also comfort level with firearms is something that has transitioned over time. In some of the older generations, a lot more people had military experience and having grown up using firearms and having that comfort level, as well as just having more recreation time and free time. There were a lot of outdoor recreation opportunities, activities that baby boomers have participated in a lot over their life course.
And this might sound just like a bad thing for hunting culture, but this shrinking population of hunters has some broader implications in the state. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, one of the really most important things is that our wildlife and habitat programs are paid for primarily through hunting and fishing license fees and also excise tax returns that are also associated with the number of hunting and fishing licenses sold by state. And so we're talking about funding for a lot of programs that support both game and non-game species, a lot of ecosystem restoration and habitat projects, and research into what's going on with our wildlife and fisheries populations. So, you know, we're running into a situation where there's less and less funding for conservation programs because of the decline in hunting. And when we look into the future, all of the data suggests that the number of hunters is going to continue to decline.
So is it sustainable to expect to see many, many millions of dollars coming in for important things like wildlife management or restoration or preservation through all the hunting and fishing licenses? What might be some other funding alternatives?
Well, you know, there are different things that different states are looking into. Michigan's not the only state that's facing this conundrum. It's a pretty common situation across the United States, and I think state agencies have increasingly become aware and are recognizing that they need to think seriously about alternatives. Some of the things that people have been looking at on the table, even at the federal level, is collecting fees from oil and gas exploration, from mineral taxes, and using that to help fund conservation. And that's something that is showing quite a bit of bipartisan support. You know, some people have been looking into raising fees on other kinds of outdoor recreation opportunities, maybe having an excise tax that extends beyond just hunting and fishing equipment to cover camping equipment as well, maybe bird watching equipment. Some states have instituted even something like a proportion of a gas tax or something like that that's primarily devoted to funding conservation. So I don't think that it's sustainable to think about funding these programs over the long term primarily from hunting and fishing license fees. I think that it could still play a role in supporting that in the long term, but I think that we do need to be serious about looking at other mechanisms.
We are not at a point yet where we will say hunters in Michigan are an endangered species, but it sounds like it's a fair statement to say the population is somewhat on the decline.
I think so.
Rochelle Winkler, an associate professor of sociology and demography at Michigan Tech in Houghton, tracking the demographics of hunting and Michigan's shrinking population of hunters. Thanks so much for sharing your work with us, Rochelle.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
After accepting 238 proposals from cities across North America, Amazon announced it will split its second headquarters between Queens in New York and just outside Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia. That's left some cities and states who turn themselves inside out trying to win this national sweepstakes feeling, well, kind of played, kind of used. But Crane's Detroit business reporter Chad Livingood looked for the silver lining in this cloud. He's with us now via Skype to say he thinks he found it. So did Amazon use Detroit, Chad?
Well, maybe. It depends on how you look at it. You know, this was a really good case study in self-evaluation for cities, particularly Detroit, because Amazon drops this proposal a couple days after Labor Day of last year and says, we are going to land 50,000 jobs in a city, and the compensation, total compensation, is going to be around $100,000. This is an economic jackpot for whoever could win this race, given that they're one of the world's largest companies, growing faster and faster every day, getting bigger and more powerful every day, and obviously growing out of Seattle and needing to branch out to another part of the country, partly for talent. And so Detroit and other cities looked at this as an opportunity to really kind of put our best foot forward. At the same time, leaders had to really come to grips with a lot of things that people have been kind of ignoring in this post-bankruptcy resurgence of Detroit, that we still have one of the country's worst regional transit systems, the most fractured and broken in many places. And then we also just have problems getting people to move here because of our reputation, and also just sort of, you know, still kind of some people think that Detroit is taboo, just a few years removed from bankruptcy. And talent is everything now. It's the new currency in our world. And when you're a company that needs to fill 50,000 jobs, Amazon was, you know, the prospect of bringing Amazon to Detroit or anywhere really is going to be basically a black hole. And that's what Amazon does out in Seattle, as people have described to us in our reporting on this last year.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of take a long view here that this was a good exercise for the city to kind of evaluate where we are and what we need to do to improve to get to the next big H2Q kahuna comes along.
Well, you know, when we think of that scramble to dangle $4 billion in tax goodies to Amazon, I've got to wonder, didn't laying all of that out on the table hurt Southeast Michigan's future bargaining power? Look at all the information Amazon gleaned from that.
Well, you can certainly make the case that other companies that come along and they know now what Amazon was offered, and we have one, Ford Motor Company, is basically getting many of the same tax breaks to move this operation to Corktown to put down 5,000 workers and create an autonomous vehicle development hub based out of the old train station. They're getting all the same 30-year corporate income tax-free abatement that was offered to Amazon as well. So, yeah, we have definitely kind of exposed ourselves a little bit into what price we'll pay for jobs. But beyond that, I mean, this didn't end up being about tax credits necessarily. Amazon is splitting this up across two campuses in Northern Virginia, the DC suburbs, and Queens, New York. And the total tax credits that are being offered between the two entities is about $3.8 billion. If it was all about money, there was other people willing to pay more. I mean, New Jersey offered $7 billion. And so this came into a bigger argument about the availability of talent, the availability of transit, and quality of life matters. You know, when people come to Southeast Michigan and they're greeted with bumpy roads and they try to go find a house and they get directed to three or four small enclaves with relatively overpriced housing already, where they're told these are the best schools, well, that's not really necessarily the recipe for attracting new businesses and people to the region.
So that process kind of made us hold a mirror up, do it in 6 short weeks of putting that proposal together. So looking in that mirror, as you say, illustrated some of the things that need fixing in Southeast Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, this proposal and what we, you know, sort of had to come to grips with, it can really be used as a guidepost for our policymakers, particularly our incoming governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and the new legislature that takes office January 1st. They can use this information, these lessons, and they've talked about it. I mean, even though we've been out of the running since January, I don't think a week has gone by this year where I haven't heard either candidates for governor or business leaders in some sort of fashion talking about the Amazon bid and what we learned from that. I think it's an instructive lesson that we'll be continuing to build on if we do it right, if we take it to heart and take it as Jerry Anderson, the DTE CEO, said to me, a kick in the pants. It might be just a kick in the pants that we needed.
Chad Livengood, Cranes Detroit Business. Always great talking with you, Chad. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, a different perspective on the comeback in Detroit from a leading urban scholar.
Well, it's real, but it's very limited.
We'll talk about the G word, gentrification. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Any conversation about Detroit's comeback very likely includes talk of gentrification, and usually not in a positive light. One leading urban scholar believes gentrification is happening, but only in a small handful of Detroit neighborhoods, and it's not all bad. With us now, Alan Malik, author of The Divided City, Poverty and Prosperity in Urban America. He's an urban scholar and a senior fellow at the Center for Community Progress. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Alan, how real is Detroit's comeback?
Well, it's real, but it's very limited. I mean, what you see going on in downtown and midtown and a couple of neighborhoods is absolutely amazing. But you don't have to go far from that area to see an awful lot that is not. And the city is still desperately poor, and most of the city's neighborhoods are really struggling just to keep their heads above water. So you've got a real contrast between amazing revival in a few places, but real struggles in probably 90-95% of the city.
And that G word, gentrification, is thrown about today in most every conversation concerning the way cities develop. But in your view, there's capital G gentrification happening in thriving coastal cities, and then there's lowercase g gentrification happening in cities like Detroit, Cleveland, and Milwaukee. Describe this lowercase gentrification for us and why you believe it's not such a big problem here in Southeast Michigan.
Okay, the first thing is, if you look at a place like Seattle or Washington, D.C., I mean, the sheer number of people with money coming into what are really pretty small places means that just about anything is potentially going to rise in price and be priced out of where low-income people can afford it. But when you look at a place like Detroit, or for that matter, Cleveland or St. Louis, yes, there are certainly some people moving into these cities with some money, but their numbers are very small compared to the people who are there, and the amount of money is not that great. And so what you see is sort of slow increases in prices in a few areas, but at the same time, those are very few areas, and this is the big difference. In a place like Detroit, you have maybe a little gentrification in Corktown, maybe a little bit in some of the edges around, you know, Midtown. And obviously you've got something, you may or may not want to call it gentrification, but something big going on in downtown, though a lot of it having to do with Dan Gilbert's amazing investments there. But most of the city is actually not being gentrified and not really at any risk of being gentrified, because the areas are actually getting poorer. You have large numbers of middle class, particularly African-American middle class families, who've simply left these neighborhoods over the last 10 or 15 years. And that's a far more pervasive reality in a city like Detroit than gentrification.
When you think about that term gentrification, how is it being used and understood in Detroit? As you examine Detroit and talk to Detroiters, what do they think gentrification is?
Well, gentrification is one of those words that has a lot of different meanings depending on, you know, where you stand, basically. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, you know, at one level, gentrification is this very specific thing about neighborhoods where affluent people are moving in and prices are going up and the low-income people who used to live there can't afford to live there anymore. That's kind of, if you will, gentrification one. But for an awful lot of people, it's really become about a much broader issue and a much deeper issue that affects the city. And I think this is important to appreciate. It's about powerlessness and the imbalance of power. So if you live in a struggling neighborhood in Detroit, you know, where you're seeing houses, abandoned houses nearby you, or public services are inadequate, or the schools are inadequate, you feel you're powerless to have any influence over what happens. That, in a way, now obviously that's not gentrification in the gentrification one sense. But the word has come to encompass a lot more than just those neighborhoods where prices are going up. It's come to embody the whole feeling, I think, that people have that they simply have no control over the future of their neighborhoods and that decisions are being made that they're being basically left out of.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with urban scholar Alan Malik as we talk about gentrification and what has led to, in Detroit's comeback, air quotes here, to Detroit's. You advocate for drilling down on neighborhood issues, but we see so much energy going toward big, flashy projects, the District Detroit with Little Caesars Arena being a prime example, you know, luring big business in with tax breaks and the like. Is that a problem with the culture of economic development that leaders just get attracted to those glitzy, sexy things?
Well, I think we always have had a problem with our focus on sort of the mega projects, and we love sports teams. And, you know, there's something to that. I mean, the local pride, tourism, and so forth, but not a heck of a lot. Ultimately, I think we really missed the boat. And I think, you know, you saw that, you know, in the recent Amazon HQ2 decisions. And what was really interesting, what they said, the Amazon people said about why they went to New York and, you know, the D.C. areas, where a lot of places has offered them a lot richer incentives, you know, and tax breaks and things like that than New York or Arlington County, Virginia. They said it was because of the human capital that these places offered. And I think cities that focus on mega product projects and don't focus instead on how do you build the human capital of the people who live in the city, their skills, their workforce relationships, their ability to get and hold good jobs. Cities that don't do that are missing a major bet, because that's probably infinitely more powerful as a tool for economic development in the long run than a stadium or an arena.
You have said, and many agree with this, that Detroit is just too big to bring back all of its neighborhoods, Alan. So how do winners and losers get picked?
Well, first, I don't think you want to necessarily pick them, because I make a somewhat different point. You can't turn, certainly not in the short run, ultimately, to make a neighborhood really turn around and revive, you need to have demand. And Detroit's awfully big, and demand still is pretty weak, pretty limited. So I think to some extent, you have to look at neighborhoods that are best situated to attract demand in terms of certain things. But at the same time, what I say, and I really believe this very strongly, is that every neighborhood has the ability to be a decent neighborhood. That doesn't mean it's going to become wonderful. It doesn't mean that people are going to start building $500,000 houses or anything there, anything like that. But every neighborhood can be a place which is basically safe, reasonably clean, healthy, and a decent place to live.
Yeah, we have seen a problem, Alan, with investors betting on Detroit's future in neighborhoods through things like the tax foreclosure auction. Allie Gross of the Detroit Free Press wrote a big investigative piece describing just how this practice contributes to decline of neighborhoods. What do you make of property tax foreclosures and the involvement of investors in this?
I think it's a tough one. I mean, you have to have property tax foreclosures. If a city wants to survive financially, you have to make it clear that you have to pay your property taxes. And if you don't pay your property taxes, there are consequences. You don't want to make it a voluntary option for people. So you need some way to make sure that people do pay their taxes. At the same time, I think there are better ways to do it than to allow, you know, speculators to slurp up a huge part of the properties that come through foreclosure. I think this is where I would much rather see, you know, Detroit work with the land bank to see that those properties go into the land bank and that the land bank have strategies to get them back to use. Or I know they've been working on some really interesting ideas to get tenants to become homeowners of some of those properties. But I think you definitely need to create a system that does not encourage speculation. So I think that needs work. It probably would need changes in state law, but I think there are ways to do it.
How fragile is this comeback in Detroit?
It's really hard to say. I mean, the shifts nationally that we see in places like, you know, Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, all of these older cities, I think they're very real, and I think firmly grounded up to a point. I think in Detroit, I think you've got a couple of things that sort of give me a little bit of pause. One question is how much, and this is kind of wacky. I mean, the last I saw an article somewhere that said Dan Gilbert, and I assume this means Dan Gilbert and other people he's working with, have invested, I think I saw $4.5 billion in downtown real estate, both acquiring and rehabilitating and putting these old buildings back into use. Now, that is mind-boggling. And that's obviously jump-started some change that would probably have, at best, been a lot slower if he hadn't made that kind of investment. But the question is, when you have so much riding on one person's investments, is that sustainable? It's hard to tell. So I think it's real, But at the same time, I think it could be quite fragile. And I think one of the things, and this is the toughest thing at all, that cities have got to be able to chew gum and walk at the same time. They have to address the issues of poverty, the issues of neighborhood distress, unemployment, schools, and all that, because that is fundamental to their future. But at the same time, the revival is also fundamental to their future. And they've got to make sure that it's nurtured and it keeps going, because I do think it's fragile. And it could, if things don't go that well, it could disappear. We ought to remember, the last 10 years, or close to that, have been a period of pretty steady economic expansion of the national economy. So to a large extent, cities like Detroit have benefited from that. But as we all know, what goes up doesn't always stay up. So ultimately, there are going to be downturns, and Detroit has got to kind of prepare for what's going to happen when the national economy and perhaps the regional economy and the state economy do go through their downturn.
Well, there's a lot of food for thought in what you say, Alan Malik. And we should remind everyone again, his book is The Divided City, Prosperity and Poverty in Urban America. And Alan will be speaking tomorrow evening, 6 p.m. at the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for speaking with us today. It was really a lot of interesting perspectives.
Well, thank you.
News broke this week that Dan Gilbert is selling his Greektown casino. Sticker price, $1 billion. That has some people speculating Gilbert may be eyeing another big ticket purchase, the Detroit Tigers. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Now, Daniel, just to be clear, Gilbert already owns an NBA team, the Cleveland Cavaliers, but owning a casino blocks him from owning a Major League Baseball team?
Yes, baseball has those rules that the owner of a casino or casino interest cannot own a franchise. And some of your listeners may remember that when the Ilitch family decided to get into the casino business when it was approved for Detroit, Marion Ilitch, along with her husband Mike, were owners of the Tigers. And in order to satisfy Major League Baseball, they essentially split the two. Marion Ilitch was no longer an owner of record of the Detroit Tigers. She was the owner of the Motor City Casino, and Mike Ilitch was the owner of the Tigers, and that apparently satisfied them. But that's an example of one of the barriers that Dan faces. Also, he has other gaming interests. He didn't just own Greektown Casino. His Jack Entertainment Company has six properties in, I think, three or four states, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Maryland. So there's a couple of questions here. One is he unwinding his whole investment in the entertainment business? And based on some reporting I've done, I think the answer to that is yes. How long that happens and how long that takes, it remains to be seen. The gaming industry is going through some consolidation. There's a new model in the industry now where you have operating companies that actually run the gaming inside the building. And then the building and the property are owned by property companies, essentially. And the property companies get the first right on cash flow that comes through the businesses.
So it might be a good time to make these kinds of moves. But how quickly did the wondering aloud about a possible Tiger purchase start after we learned that Gilbert is selling Greektown?
Oh, this has been going on for more than a year. And I think it's been related to two things. One is the death of Mike Ilitch, and a belief by some people who think they know what's going on that Mike was a baseball guy because he played in the Tigers minor league system, and he always called himself a baseball guy. And his son, Christopher, who runs the company for the family and is the president of the Tigers, is really a, quote, hockey guy. Mm. Chris has, however, told me personally that he's more of a baseball guy. And the interesting thing is there on two occasions, Chris Ilitch has done on-the-record interviews with the Detroit News, once with me and once with my colleague Lynn Henning. And in both cases, he's emphatically said that the Ilitch family is committed to long-term ownership of the Detroit Tigers. The organization has also, in a third case, issued a public statement saying the same thing.
Okay.
Which seems to make absolutely not a whit's difference to the people who are out there speculating that Dan Gilbert wants to buy the Tigers. It's easy to add two and two and get five or six, and that's what I think we're seeing here. But as I point out in my column today, things can change. owners do die. That does happen. Mike Ilitch died. Bill Davidson, the owner of the Pistons, died. William Clay Ford, the owner of the Lions, died. Ralph Wilson, who has been a lifetime resident of Grosse Pointe Shores, I mean, the original owner of the Buffalo Bills.
Right.
When he died, his trustees sold the team. So, you know, Chris Ilitch and the family may be saying, we're in this for the long haul, but, you know, what is the long haul? At some point, the family may sell the team, and someone can say from their death, but see, I was right. I was right.
Eventually.
But I think based on my reporting and some of the issues that face Dan, I don't think that's likely to happen anytime soon. Now, there has been a recent Supreme Court decision that has taken a different view on sports betting, and I think it will be liberalizing it, and a lot of people expect that sports betting will be liberalized around the country. And in fact, the new owner of Greektown Casino has already gone on the record with us at the Detroit News and saying, we want to institute sports betting in Greektown Casino. Mm. And for that to happen, the legislature in Lansing has to pass the requisite laws to make that possible. So we're already seeing that could change. And, you know, this is one of the biggest sports towns in America. So I'm sure there'd be more than a couple people that would want to do betting in that casino on sports.
So we kind of, as you quoted someone in your column, the director of a lawyer who's a sports law expert, it's the gamblization of sports, and what better place to happen than in the Motor City?
Well, I don't know about what better place, but it's probably a place, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, sports crazy Detroit. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Being a freshman in college is exciting, meeting new people, figuring out just who you are. But big changes can also trigger or worsen mental health disorders such as anxiety and depression. If untreated, these disorders can prove to be fatal. Suicide is the leading cause of death among college students, and all too often, parents have no idea the student was struggling. Today, we talk about preventing suicide among college students. And we begin with Colleen Edmonds of Oakland County, a board member with the Michigan chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Her daughter, Megan, died by suicide in 2014 after her freshman year of college.
Our daughter was gifted academically. She had many friends. She was state champion lacrosse player. You know, she was a happy kid.
Colleen says Megan was excited to go off to the University of Michigan, and she seemed to be doing well. But when her high school boyfriend broke up with her in the fall, things began to unravel.
We still have her phone, so we have seen every text and every message, and we didn't know that she could not get over that.
Megan was hospitalized overnight in the U of M psychiatric ward in January 2014. In July, while her family was out of town and she was home, Megan died by suicide. This loss has driven Colleen to become an advocate for suicide prevention. I sat down with her to talk about her work and just what schools and parents can do to support students who are struggling. How do you think colleges, let's talk in general because there are parents of college kids all over listening, how could colleges do a better job about being proactive when it comes to mental health on campus and problems that students are facing?
Well, right now, I know at Michigan now, they have more peer support groups, which I think helps the students immensely because really no one wants to go speak with a 55-year-old woman or a man.
Tell mom and dad.
Right, or tell mom and dad. So now, you know, the Active Minds is on campus, and it's on 400 campuses throughout the country. Wolverine Support Network started pretty much right after Megan passed, and her roommate was very involved in that. I just think that the schools need to train their faculty better to look for signs when people are struggling. I know for a fact that Megan's RA was never notified after Megan's January incident, and she had thought that he would be. She texted me every day and said, Mom, I'm so embarrassed to walk down the hall in my dorm. I don't know if people know what happened. And then each day I said, you know, has your RA reached out to you? And he hadn't. And in fact, he didn't even know about the incident.
Talk to us about this whole part that parents, especially first time kid going to college, you realize privacy. You don't get to know everything, grades or things going on. How does a college balance the privacy laws with perhaps letting family members know? What do you think? What did you learn
That is my mission, to have some things changed. I'm an advocate for suicide prevention. I went to an advocacy forum, the annual forum in June in D.C., and we went on Capitol Hill to speak with our representatives and speak with senators.
Because do we agree that university and college schools' hands are tied?
They are tied. But I guess you can also, with the HIPAA laws, if your child has to get hospitalized for anything, you can sign and have your child sign that prior to school. And I think I really think it's a wise thing.
To give you access to.
To give you access. Okay. You know, and some children maybe don't want it, and that's fine. But, you know, I think that it really would be something that if I had to do over, I would have done. There is also the Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act that I don't think that a lot of people are aware of. And what that is if you are a dependent and you claim your child on your taxes, then you have a right to know their grades. Because that is key when you have an 18-year-old, and actually sometimes they're 17 when they go off to college.
Mine was.
You know, you can't just be thrown into an adulthood at 18. I think a lot of times they lack the resources to make those decisions.
The emotional resources.
The emotional. And I think kids these days are not, you know, back when I was in college in the mid-80s, if you failed, it was more of a disappointment. Now, if you fail, it's you are a failure. And I think kids, they're not versed in that. You know, it's okay to fail. And you were not a failure because you got a C or a D on a test. And I think that's really difficult. I think today's kids have so much pressure.
What do you wish you had known about mental health and about suicide and college pressures before your child went to college? What do you think parents right now should know about the reality of mental health and suicide before packing your child off to college?
Well, I think you need to have the discussion with your child that, you know, mental health is as important as your physical health. And, you know, it's okay to ask for help. I mean, it always was a stigma, and we have to break that stigma. It's very easy for kids to feel that if I go for help, someone's going to think, oh, she's crazy or he's crazy. And in reality, that's not the case. And, you know, 1 in 4 college students suffer from anxiety is really the number one issue. You have to have that discussion with your child that it's okay not to feel okay. And everybody has had times where they don't feel okay.
And really, what you're saying, it strikes me, needs to start when they're tiny and try to give them that sense all the way through.
Exactly.
Because as you say, they go off now without that emotional toolkit to weather what they're going to face mm-hmm. when they are in this big new world.
Right. You know, and we had a couple of suicides in our area prior to, you know, my children going off to college. And I sat down with them and had talks about it. And they said to me both, like, Mom, we could never, ever do something like that. Never would it ever be a possibility. And I know in my daughter's case, it was a snap that night. You know, she had people at our house, and she had been drinking. And I guess I didn't know to the extent that she was self-medicating. And she and I were really, we were so close, you know, like best friends. And, you know, I think she was embarrassed about asking for help. And, you know, the reality is we need to stop this stigma.
What keeps you in this fight?
Because this never should have happened. Our daughter, that night in January, she didn't know, she didn't remember, but there was a police officer who he had reached out to her at our house the next day, and he told her she wrote a note. And when she got back to school, she found this note. We never knew about this note.
What was the note?
It was a chicken scratch note that said, "Mom, Dad, and Brian, my son, I can't live like this anymore. I will see you in heaven." And we found it in August. Megan passed away in July. So we contacted the school, and I was really, my husband and I were so upset that that note was never brought to the hospital. And again, the school said it's students' property, and they could not bring it. And when I met with the hospital months and months and months later, and I met with the head of the psych ER, and I told her about the note, her face went ashen white. And I said, "You didn't know about a note, right?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, will that have made a difference?" And she said, "Yes." And so it took me about 5 months to get the school to let, if there is a note, to bring that to the hospital.
Colleen, what do you do as a family to remember and to celebrate Megan's life?
Oh, we remember her every day. We celebrate on July 11th. The first year we had all of her friends, and we had a huge barbecue in our backyard with over 100 people coming in, you know, mid-July to celebrate her. You know, holidays, she's always remembered. And, you know, every day we have pictures of her around the house. I talk to her every single day.
Colleen Edmonds is a board member with the Michigan chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Colleen.
Thank you so much for having me and letting me share the story.
The Michigan chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention will hold meetings all around Michigan this coming Saturday for survivors of suicide. You can get information and the locations by going to afsp.org. A key part of preventing suicide among college students is getting them the mental health care they need. And that's what Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farha Abbasi does every single day. I talked to Dr. Abbasi about what's driving the high rates of mental health issues on campus and when it's time for students and families to reach out for help. You have said very consistently that students today face greater levels of stress and mental health issues than any other generation.
Yes. I think, Cindy, we don't realize that this generation that's growing up has seen many changes economically. We have seen meltdowns. We have seen many wars. Beside that, unemployment versus level of education needed to get into the system. So on one hand, we are setting them up that until unless you have this education, you can't get anywhere in life. But on the other hand, the job market is shrinking and the college student loans are getting higher.
And we see the results of this stress. According to the American College Health Association, the suicide rate among young adults aged 15 to 24 has tripled since the 1950s, and suicide is now the second most common cause of death among college students. You've got to realize statistics like these are terrifying.
It's scary. It is a silent epidemic, and I don't know what will it take for us to wake up to it.
When you think of the reasons for this, college age, high school age, you mentioned the expense of the degrees and the pressure to get degrees. What are some of the other reasons that this stress is being so fueled?
So let's take it back from school level. What is happening is this is the first time the kids are expanding their world. So this is the first time they are getting exposed to peers. They are getting exposed to what is right, what is wrong. They're trying to identify role models. this can be a really hard time because, on the other hand, we have this horrible things happening like bullying and also the services, the resources are shrinking. So if you look at an average school might have a school counselor, but what are they basically helping the kid with is more like academic stuff, you know, what classes to choose, how you are doing in classes. But we look at this way that an average kid is spending more time at school, being exposed to all these forces. I don't think even our school systems are set up to meet the needs of a growing kid. They don't have the guidance that's needed. And that's the time when they cultivate their core values, who they are going to be as a person. And this is the time, if we nurture it and provide the support, that they can then develop that sense of worth and self and have that resiliency then to cope with when they come to college.
When you think of the kinds of things that are all over in the headlines, sexual assault, substance abuse, concerns about gun violence in schools and on campuses, eating disorders. And then it's just lifestyle habits, too. You often talk about sleep deprivation, which is a problem not just for college-age students, but we hear it for high schoolers as well.
Most important thing that the kid requires at this time is having a structure at home and having those communication channels open. So you have to understand, as a parent, you are not their adversary. You are not there to control them, but to be their ally, be their advocate, help them navigate this new stress. But also, the conversation also is changing from books to bullets, right? So now, as a parent, as a kid, you have to worry about your safety. What if you have an active shooter? It's a reality that every school now has to talk about and have resources for. So imagine a small kid going to school to worry about all the dangers now surrounding them.
These seeds are being planted at a young age, and then as we pile things on as they get older, they really come home to roost. Now, for parents, especially parents of youngsters who are not living at home, they're on a campus. How can we parents tell when things are going badly before we're in an all-out crisis?
So I think we talked about any sudden changes of behavior. When a kid gets to college, they suddenly are caught between being this new adult and still a child in some ways. They are seeking fun. They think, oh, wow, there is no parents. We have access to resources. Let's party, right? But again, the thing that you have to look out for is sudden changes of behavior. So the thing is someone using excessive, maybe alcohol. Other thing is, are they missing school? How are they keeping up with finances? Who are they hanging out with? What is their peer support, peer group like? But important ingredient again comes is what kind of relationship you have developed with them. Because now you have to start treating them as an adult, and they should be responsible for their behavior, and you are just empowering and validating that.
When is it time, Dr. Abbasi, to seek professional mental health care for your student?
So there is two things we look at. One is severity and other is functionality. So severity will come out if they are trying to hurt themselves or getting angry, irritable, aggressive, violent towards others. The first criteria is safety, safety, and safety. Second thing is something small as, are they buying guns? Are they getting more interested in, let's say, substance abuse? So these are the behaviors to look for. Other thing becomes functionality. Are they keeping up with their friends? Are they keeping up with their educational demands? How are they doing with their relationships, with the family, with loved ones? Any changes in that is a red flag.
So when a parent and a youngster together decide, all right, I need help, call and get me an appointment, what are the resources there in our state? Do we have enough mental health professionals to help the kids and the teens and the young people?
unfortunately, that is the biggest crisis we are dealing with right now. The ratio provider to patient ratio is, like I was just looking up numbers, we are hardly meeting 28% needs of our patients. And at the same time, you are seeing that states and federal budgets are cutting resources. You don't have enough patient beds. Like, let's see, a child who needs urgent care, we have to go up to Ann Arbor or maybe go further to find that bed. That is definitely an issue that we all have to seriously look into and invest in.
Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farah Abbasi. Dr. Abbasi, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.